Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Hello and welcome to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson, and Professor Alistair McGrath. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. That's premierunbelievable.com. But now for today's show. In this series, C.S. Lewis expert Professor Alistair McGrath is delving into the Space Trilogy, arguably one of Lewis's lesser-known works of fiction. We'll be exploring the three books in the trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra, and That Hideous Strength. Alistair, what were some of the opinions around extraterrestrial life during Lewis's day? And do we have any idea whether he believed that there was extraterrestrial life, aliens, things like that? Or is this pure fiction in Lewis's mind?
Well, Lewis did make it clear that he wanted his science fiction to be read as fiction. But one of the things that Lewis does through his fiction is to open up the kind of supposal type question. Suppose there are people living in other worlds. How might we know about them? How might they get redeemed? A whole series of questions like that. And very often you find Lewis using these narratives as ways of, in effect, exploring questions. On some of these issues, we're not really quite sure what Lewis believed. But actually, you can see Lewis almost, if you like, testing them out, trying ideas and seeing how they work. And so literature very often for Lewis is a kind of mental laboratory to let him explore ideas and see where they take him.
So we don't really know whether Lewis believed in aliens.
Well, there are points at which Lewis does discuss this, but I have to say it always seems to me to be slightly hypothetical, slightly cautious. And the way I tend to look at it is Lewis has no fixed views on these things, but is nevertheless trying to explore what if, and then how might you respond to that?
And do you think he sort of challenges the traditional depiction of aliens in science fiction? And if so, what are some of the kind of underlying theological implications of his approach?
I think one of the things that we see in this trilogy is, if you like, a critique of the natural human tendency to make judgments about life forms before you fully understand them. And Lewis brings this out in a number of ways, but certainly one of the things he's trying to get across is that very often you prejudge things and you need to rethink things because they challenge you about these things. And Lewis, very interestingly, doesn't depict alien life forms in critical or negative ways, simply saying, look, they're there. Let's get used to this and try and come to terms with them as we find them. What is really interesting from my perspective is that the life form that is criticized most, particularly in That Hideous Strength, is other human beings. In other words, Lewis is making it pretty clear he regards humanity as in some way being malformed or deficient or contagious and capable of spreading this contagion to other places in the universe. So I think that there's a real concern here about how human beings very often make misjudgments, and that reflects things about us that we need to confront.
Now, Lewis had a background in medieval literature, mythology. Are there influences of his background in the Space Trilogy? And if so, how do they enrich the narrative, do you think, Alistair?
Well, I think Lewis's interest in medieval legends does lead him to kind of begin to bring these images and these influences into the narratives. For example, in Perelandra, we have this beautiful image of the dance. And I mean, that is an image that's explored a lot in medieval and Renaissance literature. And Lewis, I think, makes very good use of that image. But basically what he's doing is he's taking something he knows very, very well from his professional life and transplanting it into his science fiction novels. And again, a lot of the imagery you find, particularly in Perelandra, has its origins in the kind of Renaissance literature that Lewis knew so well. So if you like, he's bringing his imagination to bear on the writing of these stories, and the imagination is kind of way influenced by his knowledge of medieval literature.
And do you think we have to understand all of these references in order to enjoy the narrative, or can we read it without the kind of background of Lewis's understanding?
I think I have to say, I very often, in reading these novels, find myself saying, I think I know what Lewis is getting at here. Do I really need to know in order to appreciate the point he's making? In other words, is he simply ornamenting the narrative with his medieval allusions, or is he making points through them so you need to understand the original context to actually get the point he's making? I think there are points which you do need to understand them, and my concern is that makes it very difficult for a modern reader to entirely grasp what he's getting at. So I think we have to say that perhaps we are not getting as much out of reading these books as we might otherwise have done. For example, if you go back to his first novel, which is A Pilgrim's Regress, Lewis later came to see that a lot of the allegories he used were simply incomprehensible, and almost apologized to his readers, saying, look, I think I overindulged myself here, and I'm sorry they were so difficult to understand.
Alistair, do we know if any of the inspiration for some of the characters in these books, I mean, we'll touch on these in more detail when we look at the specific books, but do we know if any of that inspiration came from Lewis's real life, or are they totally made up, as he sort of seems to imply in the preface of Perelandra, where I think he says that the human characters are purely fictitious and not allegorical? I mean, is that true? Are they fictitious, or are they sort of based on things that he knows?
I think what Lewis is doing here is in effect saying, don't think I'm writing about people who I know here. But in fact, I think it's very, very likely he was. It's almost certain he's drawing on characters he knew in the senior common room at Magdalen College at Oxford University, some of whom were apparently quite strange. And I think Lewis might well have said, oh, I could work that one into a story. So I think there's that sort of thing going on. There are also various public figures you feel might be being transposed to these imaginary realms in very interesting ways. I think what we have to say is it's very likely that Lewis is indeed basing some characters on people he knew. Maybe they are composite characters, but certainly I think that Lewis is basing his fiction on people he knew all too well from the world around him at Oxford.
Well, I think it's probably fair to say that perhaps one of those is the key figure, Ransom. I mean, is it significant that a number of the characters in the trilogy are philologists? Is that how you say? Is it philologists?
Philologists, yes, indeed. Yes, it is significant. And of course, when you say philology, you think J.R.R. Tolkien. Okay. So again, you may have that. Or again, this simply may be Lewis's way of saying, actually, you know, philologists have their virtues. They're very important people. We need intelligent people like that to help us understand things. So you feel that Lewis is perhaps making some quite important points that might please his friends in that way.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith and the Evidence for God apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to science, faith, and the evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. Thank you for your support.
Who do you think is the narrator in these books? Because he seems to be a philologist as well, doesn't he?
Yes, I mean, Lewis does have a sort of narrative continuity here. And obviously, where you have a narrative thread, very often the narrator will make judgments, will bring things in, which kind of way give you an idea of how you should interpret the story at this point. And I think the narrator really is Lewis himself. I think Lewis is kind of way putting his own ideas into the minds of those who are observing and reflecting and so on. But I think it's very difficult to avoid doing that. And Lewis clearly felt that the way he chose to do it worked, and therefore he was very happy to keep it going. Although I have to say, the narrative style of each of these three books is quite different. The Isle of the Silent Plans is a very straightforward narrative. In Perelandra, it does change, and it changes even more in the third and final novel in the sequence.
Did we know? I mean, there was, as I was reading Out of the Silent Planet, I you know, it sort of came up with I this and I that, and I sort of circled it. It was like, who's I? Who's I? Do we know why the narrator, the person of the narrator, isn't really introduced until the end of the book? Was that kind of an intentional technique, or had he maybe not decided whether it was going to be himself, or what's going on there? Because that was slightly confusing, I thought.
Well, it is a technique, and I think it's an understandable one, whereby, you know, as you read a narrative where you're being told a story, very often you want to know, well, how reliable is the narrator? Who is the narrator?
No.
Who's telling me the story? Do they have an agenda? How trustworthy are they? And of course, one of the key points here is that, you know, we eventually are told who the narrator is, but the point is it's kept a secret. And I think that's a narrative device to keep us guessing. So we find that in other works of literature. So it's obviously a trope, a way of writing, a way of thinking that Lewis is familiar with.
There's quite a lot of moments, isn't there, in the novel where Lewis seems to be mixing real and fictional elements. For example, Oxford and Cambridge University compared to Edgestone University, which is obviously a made-up university. I mean, did he do that intentionally?
Well, I think Lewis, again, had to protect himself against seeming to criticise certain known people or certain known institutions. Therefore, the best way of doing this is to create an invented universe where certain of its aspects might well bear a very close relationship to ones in this world, but Lewis didn't want to actually say that. So I guess what Lewis is trying to do is to create fictional counterparts of real-life institutions as a way of helping him to explore what can go wrong with these things, what their problems are, how they could get something right. So I think we could just say that Lewis is really really using a technique which is very well established, which is using fictional counterparts to allow you to imagine what the strengths and the weaknesses of existing institutions and individuals actually are.
And are some of the details that he includes, I guess because he's using a sort of mixture of real and fictional, it's quite difficult to know what is actually accurate or what is just fiction. For example, when he's talking about the planets and I guess like the characteristics of the planets, is that accurate or is that just something that he's kind of created from his own head?
I think he's created it not simply from his own head, but rather from his own head informed by science fiction writing on these topics. So I think in many ways what Lewis is doing is reflecting a well-established literary tradition of thinking about these things. But again, Lewis is really constructing an imaginative framework within which he wants to explore certain questions. And to do that, he's got to hold his reader's attention. So therefore, he really needs to construct an interesting narrative with descriptions of things that hold your attention. So you can see why he's got to develop these in order to keep you reading.
You mentioned, Alistair, that you know, some of this is really quite difficult to read, but I was actually struck by quite how funny some of these books were. There was just some great one-liners. I'll just read some of them. It says, the lady was apparently a British innkeeper of that Orthodox school who regard guests as a nuisance. And then there's another line, which, so that's from Out of the Silent Planet, which I just thought was hilarious. And then there's another line in That Hideous Strength, which says, fellows of colleges do not always find money matters easy to understand. If they did, they probably would not have been the sort of men who became fellows of colleges. And there just was a couple of moments like that where I was quite sort of surprised by how humorous Lewis could be. Because I guess I don't think I've personally seen that side of him. Was there a kind of intentional style that Lewis had when he was writing the Space Trilogy, do you think?
Well, that's a really interesting question. One of my doctoral students here at Oxford has been working on humour in C.S. Lewis's writings. And certainly he has really brought out very clearly, I think, the way in which Lewis uses humour in a number of ways. One is to make the narrative more readable and more engaging. I think you've picked up on that very well. The other is to use humour as a way of allowing you to encounter difficult ideas but not be frightened by them. I think it's a way of, in fact, opening up a conversation about some difficult questions where you feel, I can cope with this because it's being presented in a very jocular or very easy to understand way. So I think Lewis is quite funny at points in narratives. I think actually he's even better in The Chronicles of Narnia. So maybe we can see this trilogy as a testbed for the creative use of humour in Narnia.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. We were hearing there from Professor Alistair McGrath, talking about one of Lewis's lesser-known works of fiction, The Space Trilogy. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. That's premierunbelievable.com. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.